The tank is a dash-out way to glory. It's down there at the other end of the ravine. Oh, don't be alarmed. It's in our hands. It came out of the garage port and came right straight toward us. We hit it with bazookas, and they didn't even dent it. But it didn't fire back. It went right straight down to the end of the ravine there, and threw out an intercom through an atmosphere lock, and said it wanted to talk to the Hockner leader. It wanted a guarantee of safety in return for cooperation. Johnny was getting into the warm boots. Well, go on. It's a kind of weird scene, continued Robert. When they got a safety guarantee that came out of the tank, they said they were the Chamko brothers. We got interrogation going. They said they knew Turtle had sold out. It seems there was a mine manager named Char, a friend of theirs, who turned up missing at the firing. Well, this Char told the Chamko brothers that there'd been a murder, that Turtle had murdered the head of the planet so he could appoint a new planet head named Care, and that Care, this afternoon, had denied them ammunition for the tank. The Chamkos claim Turtle and Care have sold out to some race called the Hockners of Duraleb, and even launched the drone to wipe out the other mine sites. I suppose it's mostly correct, said Johnny, except the parts about the Hockners and the drone. The Cyclos have a lot of enemies, but according to their histories, they defeated the Hockners a couple of hundred years ago. Listen, Robert, in all due respect, I've got to be going. There's more, said Robert the Fox. They haven't got tank and plane fuel in there, and we've cut down four sorties of theirs to get to the fuel and ammunition dump way over there. But they have plenty of blast rifle ammunition. We don't have men enough for an assault. What else? Said Johnny. Sounds like good news, not bad. Well, it's not all good news. It seems there's 16 levels of compound under us. Each level stretches for acres. Quarters, shops, garages, hangars, offices, workrooms, libraries, supply warehouses. I didn't know it was that much, but that's not bad news either. Wait. If that thing were to be hit with radiation, this whole assault force would be blown to bits. We're fighting on a loaded bomb. We must save those planes and equipment if we have to defend Earth. And we need them for reconstruction if we really did blow up Cyclo. You'll have air support shortly, said Johnny. You can withdraw. Well, the Chamko brothers say they know what will happen in there, that we'll flood the place with air. They said they know how us Hockners took the Duraleb system back. They say there aren't enough breathe gas masks and vials, but the recirculating system has plenty. These Chamko brothers are design and maintenance engineers. They promised to help us if we paid them. They say the whole planet has been on half pay and no bonuses, and they don't want to be killed in an air flood, as they called it. Johnny had on warm clothing and was finishing a sandwich of oat bread and dried venison. Sir Robert, as soon as you get air support, you can plan something. The Chamko brothers told us the breathe gas recirculating system was exterior to the base and air-cooled, and they were tricked into admitting all one had to do was shoot up the intake pipes from the cooling system and the pumps would fill the whole compound with air. You got it all solved, said Johnny. Yes, but we need the intake shot up at long range from the air. That shouldn't take long. As soon as Glen Cannon gets here, well, I think you ought to do it, said Robert. It's not very dangerous, and if you fire from about a half mile off, I can do that as I take off. But you should come back down here to verify. Suddenly, Johnny knew what Robert was up to. Robert the Fox was going to wait until all planes could converge on that drone. And that was taking a chance. The planes to other mine sites might be in trouble themselves. Sir Robert, are you trying to keep me from making a single-handed attack on that drone? The veteran spread his hands. Johnny, laddie, you've done too much already to get yourself killed now. His eyes were pleading. Johnny swung up into the plane. Then I'm coming with you, said Robert the Fox. You're going to stay right here and direct this assault. A mine car ricocheted into the end of the ravine and came to a halt. The driver grabbed an assault rifle and ran up to the lines to get back into the battle. Glenn Cannon stepped down and limped over to them. "Damn," said Robert the Fox.
"What's the matter?"
said Glenn Cannon, a bit taken aback with the greeting.
"I'm all right. If somebody will tape up my ribs and put something around this ankle, I can fly."
Robert the Fox put an arm around Glenn Cannon's shoulder. "It was something else," he said. "I'm glad you got back alive. We've got a job for you. A lot of them, in fact. A sniper is on the old Chinko quarters."
"Goodbye, Sir Robert," Johnny said, and closed the door.
"Good luck," said Robert, sadly. He knew Johnny would suicide crash the drone if everything else failed. He didn't expect to see him again. Then he turned and began to issue orders to two waiting runners. He had a little trouble seeing them. Johnny sent the plane soaring out of the ravine, too fast to be spotted and hit, and was on his way to attempt something the combined military powers of Earth had failed to do, and on his way to do it all alone. Waiting until the drone was, 5 hours from Scotland, was cutting it a bit close. If attacks on it did succeed, they might blow gas canisters, and a freak wind could wipe out Scotland and Sweden as well. There was much to be said for attack in force, but even that guaranteed no success, and no one had ever tried a head-on smash at the drone with a cyclo battle plane traveling at maximum with all guns blazing at the moment of collision. As a last resort, that would destroy almost anything. He hadn't said anything about it to Sir Robert. Surely the old man hadn't guessed it. 3. Dunnell Dean was a very happy man. The Cornwall compound of the British Isles was dead ahead, lit up like the one-time cities must have been. They had drawn straws for Cornwall. This was the mine site that sent out hunting parties that made it death for Scots to go south. The cyclos at this place over the centuries had gunned down people beyond count just for sport on their days off. There was even a tale of a raiding party captured and tied to trees and shot tiny bit by tiny bit and man by man for 18 agonizing days, and many tales like it. He and his co-pilot Dwight had drawn the long straw to the envy of their fellow pilots. They had drilled the navigation. No Scot had ever gotten within 100 miles of this mine site in over 1,000 years, and little was actually known of it, but they had absorbed what there was. They had lain all night, quite relaxed, warmly dressed, for stratosphere flying. They had heard the warning horns go for the final firing of the semi-annual. They had piled into their seats, hands waiting at the consoles. Wide-eyed and thrilled, they had watched Johnny's incredible sprint. Something had gone wrong as he reached the cage, and that part wasn't so good. No rescue. But Johnny had piled down under the edge of the bluff, safe as a wee bairn in his truckle bed, before the blast rifles went. The recoil had been a bit disconcerting, for it had slewed the plane out of position with concussion. But all was well. They had vaulted their plane into the sky on schedule. They had seen the planet-wide radio towers collapse in a tangle of cables behind them, hit by both the concussion of recoil and bazooka fire. A 12-hour radio silence had begun successfully, ample time for the farthest mine site to be reached without any warning. At 2,000 miles an hour, 100,000 feet up, they had shifted the clock and come down to normal cyclo approach levels to a nighttime mine site. There it was. Scanners and view screens alight, they found no sign of hostile action, no guard planes in the air. Lighted steam was coming out of some shafts in the hills that must be 5 miles deep. Smelter chimneys belched curling green smoke. Warehouses stood in bold outline. And there were the glowing domes of the compound, Target 1. But Dunnell Dean, being Dunnell Dean, was quick to take advantage of sudden opportunities, even when they were not quite specified in planning. The silly apes down there lit up the whole landing area for him. It gleamed like a bloody stage. They thought he was simply some non-scheduled cyclo flight. Bless radio silence. And Dunnell Dean saw something else.
strung on massive power poles coming down from the north, was their power supply. And right there, in the full glare of the landing area, was the obvious master pole. The freaks cared nothing about an aerial navigation menace. It was the master pole. The lines from the north came down into it. The local light cables all routed out from it to the buildings and compound. There was a big open space for landing and takeoff in the middle of this spider's web. Right at the side of the landing stage was a huge wheel. Dunnell Dean recognized it. The master wheel that, when spun, withdrew the master bus bar from the circuit. By Dunnell Dean's opportunist mentality, it was simply too good to miss. Why let them have lots of light while they rushed about manning their defense weapons and trying to get out to their planes? Why not simply throw the whole thing into total chaos? And then go up and, with infrared screens, shoot the place to bits. Their own plane had a wave neutralizer, copied from one stolen from a ground car, and they could turn it on and those apes wouldn't know what to shoot at. Further, if this battle plane took off, it would seem like it was a defense plane. Dunnell Dean spoke rapidly to a startled but agreeable Dwight. Just as casually as though they were a visiting plane, they landed right beside the big wheel. Dunnell Dean hitched the assault rifle strap over his shoulder, opened the door of the plane, stepped down, walked over to the bus bar wheel, and gave it its first spin. It all went okay just up to that point, but now a cyclo in a little guardhouse they had not spotted, only 10 feet from that bus bar, stepped out and stared at Dunnell Dean.
"The tall naps!" screamed the guard.
Before Dunnell Dean could get the assault rifle into position, the guard had closed the door and hit a siren. A bullhorn opened up enough to blast one's eardrums in.
"Tallnap attack! All posts! Tallnaps! Gun positions!"
Regardless of what tallnaps might be, Dunnell Dean spun the bus bar wheel so fast it screamed. He realized then why it was so close to the landing stage. They darkened the place for attack precautions, and had a guardhouse right handy to do it. Dunnell Dean raced back to the plane. He dove in. Dwight's assault rifle opened up as guards boiled out of a stairwell. They dissolved into luminous green flashes. The battle plane soared. Dunnell Dean threw on the wave neutralizer and infrared screens. They reverted to plan. With guns set to no flame, maximum concussion, they roared across the compound. The domes squashed like punctured balloons. They raced across the lines of warehouses and knocked their roofs flat. For good measure, they made another pass, this time dropping non-radiation anti-personnel bombs. One gun opened up at them, and the plane took a jolt. They flashed down and squashed the gun with a single blast. And that was the end of the base. The Cyclo Intergalactic Mining Company did not believe in lavishing money on safety equipment in any department, apparently. And hadn't Johnny said something about Turl calling in all the armaments from these bases? From what they could gather, standing by, way up in the air, the creatures in the compound had been unable to get the masks on before the domes were smashed, for there certainly wasn't any mob coming out. They hung around for a while, occasionally knocking out an isolated vehicle and a stray guard. It really was quiet down there after that. Then they saw something on their radar screen.